friends of the draft resistance revolution in America. Good evening. I hope it stops raining. One thing about the draft resistance that's different from other movements and revolutions in this country is that we have no enemies. And it's one of the beautiful things about it. And to show that our hearts are in the right place, we'd sing a song for the governor of California, Ronald Reagan. Zap. He's a drugstore truck driving man.
This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 425, January 25th, 1980, and this is side two of the tape. That little break in between tapes was also from Woodstock, and there's a song they were singing about Ronald Reagan, and the youth, of course, the musicians, said and expressed the idea that they didn't have any enemies. The draft resistors had no enemies. The summer of 1969 is when the United States COINTEL program, the Operation Chaos, was being formed against the youth, and they were meeting by the hundreds of thousands at the rock festivals and making fun of people like Ronald Reagan. What happened was that the group was broken up, and one of the men singing in his song to Ronald Reagan in 1969, Graham Parsons, was just one of the 40 or 45 rock musicians, I have a list and I haven't even updated the number, who I believe were murdered in a sequence after Woodstock and systematically done away. The drug case of Elvis Presley, if you read the records, began when he was stationed at an army base in Germany, and that's when they began supplying the drugs that multiplied until he was dead. And before I get back to the gun-running story of Mr. Turple and Mr. Kirkcullough in New York City, their arrest and their international gun running, I just want to say in these tapes, just at this moment, as good as any, some comments about the arrest of Paul McCartney in Tokyo. Of course, Japan and Germany were our enemies in World War II. They aligned up with the trilateral to make war against the Soviet Union when World War II was over. The trip of Paul McCartney to Japan was a tragedy because out of bad judgment or whatever, he hasn't said the marijuana, the half a pound of marijuana, was planted. He's been in jail so far. He's got a sentence of 10 or 20 days. But the order is that no more Beatle music can ever be played in Japan. Nothing that he ever wrote for them, and none of the songs afterwards from his group Wings and so forth. So that with a half a pound of marijuana, they can keep an entire culture out of Japan. We talk about censorship in various countries and human rights, and this is totally ridiculous because everyone knows that the top movie moguls and political figures are all using cocaine and marijuana. And this was evidently sold to him. Actually, if he were smart, he would have let one of his aides carry it. John Lennon claims that his problems began because marijuana was planted in a binocular case in the house, and then the house was busted. But evidently this was on Paul. But this is a serious thing. Here's a man who made approximately $50 million last year, who's bought the movie rights to all of the major Broadway plays and musicals, who's a highly successful person, a genius at composing, whose music is played everywhere, and an entire country has said you cannot play any more songs of Paul McCartney's in Japan ever again. Now, they know that as the war escalates and the arms deals escalate, that the people are going to get out again, and they're breaking off those people that are symbols of gathering large crowds. The rock musicians are getting political. They're coming out and singing for a few candidates, but the real action isn't coming yet. I'm not talking about the establishment concert of Linda Ronstadt to raise money for the Cambodian people or Jerry Brown. I mean, the real hard political statements that were done, such as at Woodstock, and Graham Parsons, one of the three that was singing the song about Ronald Reagan, dedicated to Mr. Reagan, and claiming that he's a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Graham Parsons was just one of those that met a terrible death after Woodstock. And even after his death, the body was captured and cremated out on a desert. There's a long story to the Graham Parsons death. Graham Parsons was actually a wealthy boy who dropped out of the system and went into the anti-war movement and the Roxy and ended up at Woodstock. He had originally entered Harvard as a theology student and in the fall of 1965 and then began to get a lot of acid and then became emotional, and the acid changed his mind and his politics. But he had seen enough racism in the South and was fighting racism and became politically involved and ended up in Hollywood with the music industry. And also at Woodstock, he was popular in Woodstock. And as I say, he met this terrible death, and he was making fun of Reagan and the Klan in the summer of 1969 at a time where they thought to be anti-war is to have no enemies. And what they had was the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the entire establishment of this country watching him and them and getting ready for the warfare that these individual private arms people can do. And this is the important thing. These arms dealers are all over the world with corporations and dummy fronts and making bombs, booby traps, disseminating their poison acid, not the regular kind, the kind that can kill these people, drive them crazy, so that the combination of the weapons and the mind control can wipe out the entire culture of a generation that began in the 60s that was fighting a war that would be available to fight this war if they could get their rockers together. The men in Great Britain that are involved in this gunning running haven't been interviewed. That Mr. Warren with Worldwide Connections, interesting name because E. Howard Hunt used the alias of Warren, and I think of Chief Justice Earl Warren and Warren Burger. Mr. Warren has Worldwide Connections, the retired Army colonel who was representing Great Britain in Washington at the time John Kennedy was killed, who lives in England now. And Mr. Cummings, who has his international offices in Monte Carlo, who, according to the New York Times, worked for the Central Intelligence Agency and supplies these guns for this large warehouse where they're available to people like Corcuera and Turple, who fly in and out of countries with multi-passports, wife, makeup artists, property owned by unknown companies in Liberia, not registered in Virginia or Washington, unlimited money, unlimited weapons, passports, makeups, work for the Secret Service, works for the police department, the very agencies that protect the president, security for Exxon, Scotland Yard, involved with international terrorism to make it appear like the left and to fund and arm the Third World. This is a can of worms. I will update it. This is part two on those arrests. And each week that new information comes in, I'll fill you in on it. Now, what are these men doing? I've referred on various tapes to the missing gold, the wealth, the Nazi money that left Europe after World War II that is funding these organizations through gun running, narcotics, art objects that are being passed and sold off and transferred around, and just pure gold that's in vaults and banks. The answer to the effect that they're having in arming these third worlds and putting them into the narcotics traffic business instead of raising the standard of living of these countries is found in several articles that were in the paper just this week. San Francisco Chronicle this week had a quiz. They have 20 questions a week like the New York Times. And the question asked was, is that some diplomats are saying that the vote of Afghanistan in the United Nations marked a turning point in the history of the United Nations. Why? And the answer was the third world countries used to support the Soviet Union, the self-proclaimed foe of imperialism, in their votes in the UN Assembly. Monday, the developing countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America voted almost unanimously against Russia, whom they now fear. So when I talk about the third world being the Third Reich, we are funding them through a piece of the narcotics traffic and through the international gun traffic and so forth, to win the minds and hearts so that they become fearful of the Soviet Union. The New York Times had an article this last week. The UN used to be a place where the third world nations and the Soviet Union would gang up against the United States. But now the United States has discovered that the UN can be a policy tool. And it goes on to say that the United States succeeded, along with Africans, Asians, and most of Latin America, to block Cuba from a seat on the Security Council. The United States won 11-0 vote for economic sanctions on Iran, and they prepared to demand the Soviet Union to get out of Afghanistan. The New York Times article goes on to say that the Third World is now working, and the United Nations appears to be working on our side against the Soviet Union. Now, this is a country that has been bombarded ever since their czar was kicked out. It has been tried. They've tried to push them against the wall, but with people like Turple and Kirkal and these international arms dealers of the intelligence community working from London and Morocco and with the Liberian freighters and companies and unlisted, unlimited money and corporations, that they don't have to account to anybody. They can pour money into those very countries that would be sympathetic to the Soviet Union, so that there is a symphony of all of them against the Soviet Union, and they represent our side and will help us wage that war to divide and break up the country known as the Soviet Union. Several weeks ago, I referred to the book Sabotage by Michael Sayers and Albert Kahn, the same men who wrote The Great Conspiracy. It was written in 1942 and posed the question about the bombs and booby traps and the fires and the chemical spills happening in the United States all over the country in every city. If you save papers from around the country, there's just this massive kind of derailment of trains, trucks turned over, fires, and so forth. And the book Sabotage, written in 1942, talks about specific Nazi agents that were arrested for causing these kinds of violences during World War II. There's one chapter starting on page 99 to page 105 saying how many were sabotaged, and this had to do with particular ships. And it goes into the Normandy, the French ship that the United States used for troops at the height of the war. February the 9th, 1942, the Normandy went up in flames at 2:30 in the afternoon, and a massive amount of people injured and millions of dollars of loss, and it could be a troop transport. It took provisions, 2 weeks' provisions at a time, with 2,000 men abroad. And this book, The Sabotage, says that before France fell, as early as June 3rd, 1940, the U.S. Was told through various reporters that there were Nazi spies in the United States and that they should, in quotes, observe the Normandy, this $60 million liner. The Nazis were looking at her. And then the book Sabotage tells about Nazi spy Frederick Ludwig, who wrote articles in Invisible Ink about the Normandy that were sent overseas, and how he used to visit the waterfront to examine the Normandy, and how reports were done that there were opportunities for sabotage 2 months before it was burned. Now, they traced the office that was responsible for hiring the workers on the Normandy, this ship. It was run by a William Dreschler. He organized a company called Oceanic Service Corporation. And when I talked about Oceanic Corporation for Frank Turpel, with his worldwide Nazi connections in England and in the United States and New Jersey, my attention was called to the book which I had just finished getting and reading, The Sabotage. And William Dreschel organized Oceanic Corporation. He was their vice president. And in 1934, before the war started, he was arrested. He was out on bail and charged with being a Nazi agent in the United States. In 1936, he swore that he was owed allegiance to Adolf Hitler. And it was his corporation, if you would believe it, that had Nazi guards on the Normandy and Nazi spies, that the Oceanic Service Corporation supplied guards to the ships and warehouses and the piers in New York City. A man, William Dreschel, who organized Oceanic and was the vice president, was associated with 30 or more Nazi agents who were employed on the Normandy. So when that ship went down in 1942, over 250 sailors and people were injured. $60 million luxury liner was burned up. A source of supplies to Europe was gone. They knew in advance that this ship could be sabotaged. And yet, on the docks, working at the shipyards, was a corporation that actually hired Nazis to stock this ship to send supplies over to defeat Nazi Germany. I feel that we are a conquered country, and that most people aren't aware of the massive amount of literature that illustrates the points which I'm trying to make, and that's why I pass these books to you and try to turn you on to them. I also referred this January the 11th on tape 423 to George Orwell's 1984. He had a corporation called Oceania, which was America, Great Britain, Australia, and South Africa, one part of the world, one third would be divided up. And this group would be in charge of the mindless workers, the elite that controlled, and the 13% of the outer party that carry on directives. That's tape 423. If you want to go back to the Oceanic Corporation, Oceania of Orwell, the Oceanic of Frank Turpel, and again, the Oceanic Service Corporation that had Nazis that sabotaged the Normandy. Are there connecting links or direct connections between George Orwell writing for the British government, the service? He was very much a part of the British system when he was before he wrote as a young person. He was trained in the British government and they worked overseas in India and Burma for Great Britain and then came back and wrote books. And there's an overlapping of names here and of situations. and people who not only were related and worked in the past but are working today, and it'd be interesting to put in as many pieces of those puzzles and find out about the Oceanic Service that hired Nazis that blew up the Normandy, and God knows what else, how many other things they sabotaged, and what happened to them, and are they still out, and did they set up the offices for Frank Turple in Washington, D.C. in 1977 for the escalation of the war? Last week I ran out of time. I was talking about a book called The Borman Receipt by Madeline Duke, published in 1977, same year that Turple opened his offices in Washington. And her family were all killed by the Nazis, and they had an art collection going back to the 15th century that was taken away by the Nazis. And this book is the story of their looking for the pictures and trying to get them back and locating them in a warehouse in Germany, only to have them disappear again, and trying to find out who was buying these pictures or getting them, whose hands they were falling into. They had a famous Florentine lady by Botticelli and other well-known artists that you would know by name. And these pictures, I say, surfaced at one time in 1969, and then they disappeared. And the more they tried to trace it, they traced it to an attorney who was in the Hitler's Gestapo, using another name, an alias now of Dr. Archer, former Nazi, who defended the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg. And as they traced this, they came, of course, a document which they say is not fiction, which is true, which is signed by Martin Bormann, that he took over the Goering art collection and was responsible for the location or the movement of the treasures of art that were confiscated from all over Europe and put into the till of Nazi money. And in the book, The Borman Receipt, there is a story of how Martin Bormann was in South America staying with these colonies of wealthy and influential Germans who were living there, and his connections to the Nazi mafia and the people that were killed who would catch on to the links of the gun smuggling, narcotics, and art traffic. And in this book, it says in quotes, the Nazis have worked and are working for the fulfillment of one plan they've never abandoned, to fight Russia again. Next time, as allies of America and the Western world, this is the greatest political danger of Nazism in the 70s, is the combining of our former enemies, the Germans and the Japanese. And of course, it's connected with their illegal arms traffic. The Nazi mafia makes great fortunes out of illegal armaments, while their activity is supporting subversive movements which are undermining democracy. The importance of the arrest of those men in New York City and their links to Great Britain and to South America, Monaco, all over the world, is, I believe, this connection of what the Borman Receipt talks about as the greatest political danger of Nazism of the 70, connected to illegal arms traffic. The Nazi mafia makes great fortune out of illegal armaments which support subversive movements and are undermining democracy. You see, with these illegal armaments that are shipped, as I say, to the PLO, to Amin, to Uganda, even after Amin is out, to Libya, Iraq, all over the world, they undermine any chance of the so-called Third World to get up on its bootstraps, because the gun running and the narcotics traffic and the money is put in the hands of a few who are willing to keep the masses down so that the Third World cannot develop its schools, hospitals, education. The gap between the rich and the poor is greater, and there's more weapons and more narcotics, and there's more anti-Soviet feelings, so that the German, Japanese, Nazi connections working along with the United States get involved in these operations that are now turning all of their minds against the Soviet Union. The Borman Receipt says, another great danger to my country, it's in this book on page 235, is the Nazi narcotics traffic. There's little we can do about the young who are already addicted to heroin. We've got to protect children. We've got to stop the inflow of drugs from South America. We know the men responsible for the vile trade, Bormann, Altman, Ralph, Ricord, and a dozen other Nazi war criminals who are using the South American gun running and the narcotics traffic to keep the youth down, to keep them addicted. Run by Nazi war criminals, and it goes on to say that the mafia in the world, through the use of these techniques and these interconnecting links, will be the greatest danger to the world in the 1970s. Well, the 70s are over. This was written in 77, but the 80s now are going to feel the consequence of the combination of the glut of the narcotics and the narcotic wars between the various countries and the gun running, with the intent of the Nazis and the Japanese to flood the world with the weapons and the drugs and eventually get them on our side, get independence on our side to fight Russia for that grand slam. This book talks about the Odessa, and I mentioned in another tape that one of the safe houses or inns that was bought for $500,000 from Frank Turpel was in Crewe, England, and in Crewe, England is one where one of the mysterious deaths took place for one of the men involved in that great train robbery in Great Britain that was funded. The purpose of the robbery was to put the money into the hands of Otto Skorzeny, the head of the Odessa worldwide Nazi organization. Well, in this book on the Bormann receipt, it talks about the foundations for the Fourth Reich that were laid in 1944. The organization is the Odessa that helped the escape of prominent Nazis. They have commercial, financial empires all over the world, and they're educating and financing a whole young Nazi generation, the Bormann receipt said. They have their black order in Italy where they bomb trade union meetings, and this is where the bombs and grenades could be going in France, a Nazi movement that destroys Jewish cemeteries, a national front in Great Britain. Cemeteries are being desecrated all over the United States, particularly in Brooklyn being torn up, and San Francisco areas being bombed and burned out now. This book goes into the art objects and the receipt. The Bormann receipt has to do, as I said before, with Martin Bormann signing that the art treasures and the gold would be used and put to Odessa to fulfill the dreams that they never abandoned to fight Russia again. The seeds have been planted since World War II, and as I say, all the headlines that we see are pieces sprouting out of the actions or activities of these combined groups to capture the Third World, to turn the Third World against Russia, to get the conscription going, to get the weapons going, to reinforce the CIA, and get ready this terrible tragedy of planning one war after the other. Now, I'm going to jump from the subject of the men arrested in New York City. I'll update it, as I say, as often as I can, and the Third World Movement to a book which is terribly important because this book puts in some of the little pieces of the puzzle that I keep talking about, and I want to bring out for the next week or two sections of this book. I don't know if it's hard to obtain, but I never see it on the stands. It's called Forces of Power by William Taub, published by Grosset and Dunlap in 1979. Now, William Taub's name should be a household word, but it isn't, and many of you probably never heard of it till this tape. So you heard it on this tape, and I'm going to give you a rundown of some of the things Mr. Taub is involved in. It will make your head swim, and then I'll detail them next week and the week after because, again, it links to Vatican art treasures and to counter-espionage and tons of gold that are in vaults in New York City, the transfer of gold, and mischief at the highest levels of government of these very people who are manipulating our lives all of the time. Now, the very first I heard of Mr. Taub was at the time of Watergate. There was just a little mention on a radio station. It wasn't in the newspapers, and I heard it on the radio. Roy Elwell was talking, or Jim Easton, I don't remember who, and it was in 1973, and I made a note. May 24th, 1973 is when I heard the name of William Taub, and it had something to do that he was working for Herbert Kalmbach, who was being investigated. He was Richard Nixon's bag man for assassination teams, for dirty tricks, and worked an attorney with the White House, with Richard Nixon. And I briefly heard that Mr. Taub was found dead at a Swiss border, that he was beaten up. He was supposed to have had $2 million in a briefcase on him, and I typed up that information, and at the time, $2 million was an important amount. Dorothy Hunt was supposed to have $2 million when her plane crash went down in Chicago, and $2 million seemed convenient. There were other instances of $2 million funds. And I heard on the radio just briefly that William Taub was found dead in Switzerland and that he had defended Jimmy Hoffa, had something to do with the Jimmy Hoffa case, worked for Herbert Kalmbach, and was dead. And I never could find out any more information about him. It wasn't in the newspapers. I didn't have any articles about him. This was in 1973. And in the summer of 74, when I wrote for The Realist, the Senate committee is part of the cover-up, I mentioned eight people that had died with regard to the Watergate a year later. And in the footnote of that article on page 30, I had listed Mrs. Dorothy Hunt, Representative Mills, Colonel J. Webster, James Glover, Mr. Taub, Dennis Cassini, Mrs. Topping, Lou Russell, Those were the eight people that I said a year later were primary witnesses to Watergate who had died. And I just said that Mr. Taub allegedly was working for Kalmbach, and all that I knew was that he had this $2 million and had died in Switzerland. But when I did an article, that was in 1974, I didn't have enough on Taub. And when I did the article for Midnight, July 12, 1976, it's called The Watergate Curse, 33 Witnesses Met Violent Death. I had the Watergate witnesses who died, but I didn't list Taub. I didn't have enough information at that time in 1976 to list him as a witness who had died at the time of Watergate, and it turned out that Mr. Taub had not died, and my judgment in withholding it later turned out to be correct. In this book, The Forces of Power, he does tell how they tried to kill him, how the CIA tried to kill him, and a complicated plot. He'd been involved making the movie Z about the Greek military junta, and of course, as I say, Roy Ash and our CIA had put the Greek military into power, and Theodorakis, the musician who wrote the music for Z, who was to get an award, was put in prison. And Taub had gone to Greece to get him released from prison, and he was not successful at the time. Later it was done, but they didn't want to link it to Mr. Taub's visit. He was released. But Mr. Taub described being picked up by a man named Brian Weiss and Randy Morrison, and he got into a car, and he did have a letter of credit for $2.5 million and documents, important documents, about from Flor Trujillo, whose father was killed by the CIA in the Dominican Republic. And he was taken to Swiss Alps on a place called Murderer's Row, Chemin de la Lachère. And they said to him, "You work for the leftists," and because he had wanted to release this musician. And these men said, "We're going to kill you." And they put a rope around his neck, a garrote, and it was so strong, and beat him up. He almost lost an eye. He was almost blind, and he was choking and bloody from head to toe. And they choked him and threw him down the road and left him in the snow for dead. He said he was bloody from head to toe, and there was snow around him. And he crawled to the highway, and he just laid face down in the center of the road, hoping that somebody wouldn't run over him. They took him to a hospital in France, and then to Geneva, where he was taken care of. But the United States officials, he says, not a single official American would come to his aid, and the American embassy wouldn't, and they kept the briefcase. And the American press did not cover a story. There was no major wire service. There was no story about Mr. William L. Taub in any newspaper. I just heard on the radio, as I say, once, and it picked my ear. And so Tom Davis, who has the books at Research, I've given you the address where you can order these things, got this book for me. It wasn't advertised in any book clubs, and that's why I want to turn you on to it. There's so much material of missing pieces of what I've talked about in the past in this book called Forces of Power, and hopefully maybe he could get some for you. The men were, he knew who picked him up. They were allegedly friends that left him for dead. One was taken into Germany, and he escaped from a prison. Morrison was there and was put in a tight prison, one of the tight securities, and he escaped. Another one, Mr. Weiss, was out on bail, and Mr. Taub has important connections. He's been in the White House with President Eisenhower, with John Kennedy, with Richard Nixon, but nobody would tell him who put up the bail for Mr. Weiss. Eventually, one got 3 years and one got two, and they're out. He was, for all purposes, left for dead, and the report was that he died in Switzerland. Of course, Gary Powers had his U-2 spy plane, which flew from Pakistan over the Soviet Union, and the instructions were to blow yourself up or take cyanide and die. And Gary Powers didn't die, and the Soviet Union proved that the weather reconnaissance plane was a spy plane. William Taub didn't die, and the stories he has to tell are so fantastic. Next week, we'll go into them. They have to do with the Howard Hughes Organization, with the murder of Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, the escalation of the war. He claims Henry Kissinger is a Nazi. That's the first time I've seen it in print. Le Doc Tho told him in North Vietnam when he was there that Henry Kissinger was a Nazi. This is an amazing book. Get it if you can. Ask your libraries or order it from Research. And I'm going to hopefully start next week's tape with the information in this book, because it's a bombshell, and you could see why the intelligence community would have every reason to hope that Taub was dead. And you can see why he wrote this book after he survived the ordeal that he went through and the physical condition and the pains. You can see why he got this book published. And we should all be reading it for those pieces of the puzzle again that do fit into place of how the power movers move and what ends they go to get done the very things they want, which we eventually have to pay and suffer for. Well, this is Mae Brussel in Carmel. Have a good week, and I'll be back with you next week.
Pick up your books and pick up a gun. We're going to have a whole lot of fun, and it's one.